On the heels of a record-breaking government shutdown, President Trump delivered the annual State of the Union speech last night, and we're getting analysis and your reaction to it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The president started his speech by telling a joint session of Congress that by coming together, we can break decades of political stalemate and unlock America's future.
We must choose between greatness or gridlock, results or resistance, vision or vengeance, incredible progress or pointless destruction.
Did you watch the State of the Union? Why or why not? What did you make of the president's efforts at compromise after a 35-day government shutdown? Did you hear it? Did he go far enough or not? And what did you appreciate that the president hit on? Where did it fall short? We're at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts on the State of the Union, ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So President Trump rated the State of the Union as strong, and during the address he covered a wide range of topics from infrastructure to prescription drugs to North Korea. And what was your take on this? Did you see any conciliatory message here?
Well, certainly there was the rhetoric of we need to compromise and work together and do things for the common good for the American people, not as Democrats and Republicans. So the language was all there in terms of the general commitment to the idea of compromise. But then when he started talking about specific issues that have divided the two parties, most prominently the wall and immigration and abortion, he was much more combative, like sticking to his original positions that he's always maintained and not really indicating how there will.
And I think we're having some difficulties.
And so I think that
I'm sorry, we're having some difficulties hearing you there. You're just faded out. So as you look at the overall speech, where did you hear moments of compromise?
Well, I think the places where there were more areas for compromise was when he was talking about things like infrastructure, prescription drugs, even calling for the possibility of paid family leave, something we haven't heard from a Republican president before. So I think there are some areas where the two parties could work together if they could find agreement in those areas. But again, the big areas that divide the two parties on the wall, on abortion, those are issues that are still going to be a big problem.
We're talking with UW-Madison's political science professor David Cannon about last night's State of the Union speech and getting your reaction as well. What did you hear? We're at 800-642-1234. What were you glad the president addressed in his address? What disappointed you? What do you think needs to be done when it comes to policy in the U.S. before the next State of the Union? The number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, and David Cannon, we're having some difficulties trying to get you back here on the line because that Skype connection wasn't working as well as we had hoped, but we're going to listen to a clip here from the president's speech. He did raise a point about being divisive in this country. He spoke about the state of the U.S. economy, and he segued to something he feels doesn't promote stability in legislation.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations.
So the president did not mention Special Counsel Robert Mueller's ongoing probe into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election by name, but what does he say there to you in that moment?
Well, right. When he's talking about, we can't have both peace and investigations, basically, that's a pretty strong signal to Democrats that he is not going to really be too wild about the idea of having all of his different issues investigated and potentially saying that, look, if you do investigate me, we're going to have a lot harder time compromising on things. And to me, that was one of the most negative messages from the whole evening, because it really does make it much harder to think about bipartisan compromise if the president's going to be taking that kind of an attitude about how we should get to the bottom of these serious issues like Russian interference in the election.
He and Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had a pretty tense back and forth on the State of the Union address and leading up to it. How did their relationship seem last night? Could we read anything into it?
Well, right. That's always one of the fun things to do in the State of the Union, is to watch all the body language, see how people are reacting. And the one moment that I noticed that was pretty telling was one time when the president started talking about immigration, and you could hear the rumbling on the Democratic side, like, you know, people, you know, saying things to themselves, and you could actually hear the audible kind of rumble. And Pelosi puts her hand out and basically tells him to calm down. She, basically saying, behave here. We need to pay attention to what he's saying. So that was one pretty telling moment. But then you could see other times when she clearly was getting frustrated and didn't like some of the things she was saying. And then there was the one kind of golf clap where she held her hands out very politely and almost like a mocking sort of clap. And so that was, there were some telling moments like that as well.
The speech comes under the shadow of the recent government shutdown. And as negotiations continue to come to a decision on immigration and the potential wall funding and efforts to avert another government shutdown, how did that atmosphere coming out of the shutdown affect the address?
Well, I think it made for certainly a lot of tension and people looking for some kind of answers, like how are we going to get out of this mess? And that was one thing that was not in the speech, that, the part about immigration and the wall was probably the part of the speech that was the strongest of the president in terms of sticking to his position, but the worst in terms of, like, okay, how are we going to compromise? And another thing about the discussion about the wall, he stuck to a lot of his talking points about, the crime wave and the people, the caravans coming, and we need to send troops to the border, and how El Paso was a very dangerous city where everyone was getting murdered, and then they built the wall and everything was fine. Well, El Paso was the second lowest crime rate among 20 similar-sized cities before the wall was built, and it's still the second lowest. And so it's just, there are so many things on talking about the wall where President Trump sticks to these false talking points that have been debunked time and time again. And so I don't think it did anything to move us towards anything like a compromise solution on how we are not going to shut down the government again.
Was that strategic that he didn't mention the shutdown in the speech? Do you think that was a good choice for the president?
Well, I don't know. I think he should have addressed it more directly. And I mean, I think that, had he used this as an opportunity to say, look, we're going to get this done. We're not going to shut down the government again, which is something that Mitch McConnell has said, and a lot of the other Republican leaders clearly don't want to shut down the government again. So anything like that, an olive branch extended to the congressional leadership, I think would have been very welcome last night. But that just wasn't there.
Political scientist David Cannon stays with us as we continue analysis on the State of the Union address. You can join in with your takeaways at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll turn to immigration and the Democratic response. Leader selected 2018 Democratic nominee for governor in Georgia, Stacey Abrams, who spoke about her recent work handing out meals to furloughed federal workers.
Making livelihoods of our federal workers a pawn for political games is a disgrace. The shutdown was a stunt engineered by the President of the United States.
That was Stacey Abrams there. Stay with us for more discussion on the State of the Union. You're hearing it on the Ideas Network. We're talking about last night's State of the Union speech here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump spoke about where political leaders came together in the last year. He highlighted the criminal reform package, the First Step Act. He brought up the challenge of opioids. He brought up reauthorization of the Farm Bill. But he also dedicated a portion of his speech to immigration, reminding lawmakers that they have 9 days left to pass a bill that will fund the government. He reiterated that a wall is his priority as part of changes to existing immigration policy.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
What stuck out to you about what the president has to say about immigration? The president says that walls work and walls save lives. Do you agree? What do you want to see as Congress and the president work this out? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. David Cannon stays with us, professor of political science at UW-Madison, as we explore the ins and outs of the president's second State of the Union address. Let's go to the phones now with Jim joining us from Brookfield with thoughts on the speech. Jim, hi.
Hi, good morning. What hit me was, we've been talking for the last 2 weeks about fringe movements as far as the moves to late-term abortions and the extreme versions in Virginia presented, and also talking, you know, socialism. And when those topics were brought up, the Democrats could not stand to support either one of those options. And it was kind of telling because, like, a week ago, Nancy Pelosi said she didn't even know what the governor had said, and all of a sudden, when it's brought up, they're in mass, the entire audience of Democrats just sat there. So I think it's gone from a fringe movement to part of their platform now, their official Democrat platform.
David Cannon, President Trump announced that he would ask Congress to pass legislation to prohibit late-term abortions. What did you hear there in the speech?
Well, right, on the socialism point, watching the audience, I actually saw quite a few Democrats stand up and applaud when the president said we're not going to become a socialist state, that our nation is has always been about freedom. And so there, I mean, I don't think there are any Democrats who are talking about making the United States a socialist state. There are some people like Bernie Sanders who have, you know, some policies that certainly call for a larger role for the government. But there's nobody in the Democratic Party that's talking about making the nation a socialist state. And so in a way, that was just an applause line for his base rather than a serious policy position. On the late-term abortion, that is a question that divides the Democratic Party. There definitely are some in the party who would be opposed to and are opposed to late-term abortions and others that support it. And so that very well could come up for a vote that would divide the Democrats. And I think Jim is right that that's one that is a harder one for the Democrats. But the first one on the socialist state, that was, I think, just kind of a throwaway line.
David, the president did not mention declaring a national emergency over a border wall. What stuck out to you when it came to how the president spoke about immigration?
Well, so there on the not declaring a state of emergency, I think Mitch McConnell was able to get through to the president because McConnell is very opposed to that idea, and he's made it clear for the last week that he thinks that would be the wrong move for the president to make. So it's, I think, good that the president didn't do that last night. But in terms of, you know, where we stand now on the wall and how we're going to get any kind of compromise, I don't think we're any closer now than we were, you know, when the government shutdown ended. That I think there has been little progress in terms of the talks between Democratic and Republican leaders. What the Democrats want is to spend more money to secure the border, but in a high-tech way that would actually be more effective than a wall. But much of the Republican base is sticking with the president on the wall because that was his campaign pledge that he made to the American people, and he wants to follow through on it just because he believes in walls. And so it really is hard to see how we'll get a compromise on those two pretty locked-in positions.
Immigration was also part of the response from Democrats, which was delivered by Stacey Abrams, and she's the 2018 Democratic nominee for governor in Georgia.
We know bipartisanship could craft a 21st-century immigration plan, but this administration chooses to cage children and tear families apart. Compassionate treatment at the border is not the same as open borders.
So do you see either side giving any ground or showing any compromise on immigration?
Well, not when it comes to the wall. I mean, there, I don't see how they're going to be able to get past that. So I think what probably will end up happening is that you will get more money spent on border security for things like better drug interdiction and drug detection at the ports of entry, more drones and other surveillance along the border where you really can't build a wall in many areas that's so remote. And so to give the president more money for funds for the border security, but not for the wall, I think that's probably where we're going to end up.
The Democrats also offered a response in Spanish from Javier Becerra, the Attorney General of California, during a primetime slot on the Spanish language networks Univision and Telemundo. He said President Trump has an extravagant obsession with the border wall that nobody wants. What did offering this in Spanish in terms of reaching Americans mean?
Well, I think it's something you're seeing more now in American politics over the last, say, 5 to 10 years, where there are candidates campaigning for office now who will give speeches both in Spanish and English. There's certainly many, many more ads now being run in political campaigns on Spanish television and radio than we'd ever seen before. So this is kind of the next step as a way of trying to reach a broader base of Americans, especially on this important issue of immigration and the wall. So I think it made a lot of sense for the Democratic Party to do that.
Let's go back to the phones now with Nate joining us from Milwaukee. Nate, what was your takeaway from last night?
There were some moments of bipartisanship, but some that were not. And two that were very much not, that may not have been caught by people, was that whenever he referred to the Democrat Party rather than Democratic Party, that's actually a McCarthyist insult towards Democrats. And on top of that, being from Milwaukee, I'm familiar with Milwaukee history, and one of the best mayors in U.S. at the time was a person by the name of Daniel Hone, who was a socialist mayor. So we actually got cleaner elections, better infrastructure and services out of that. And
well, Nate, where did you see bipartisanship, though, come through in the speech?
I saw a real example of bipartisanship when he talked about family leave. That was an attempt by him to compromise, I think. He didn't give Obama credit for the good economy, but he did with that, or he took a step with that.
David Cannon, what did you hear out of family leave and bipartisanship?
Yeah, I agree with Nate. I think that one of the best moments of bipartisanship and reaching out to the side, other side, was the whole series of things that he was talking about. Women and the low unemployment rate for women, and the 58% of the new jobs created have been for women. And at that point, the women all stood up and started doing their raise the ceiling thing and were clapping. And then President Trump kind of smiled and said, "You weren't supposed to do that." And then they all laughed and clapped some more. And then he said, "Oh, hang on, there's something even better coming." And then he mentioned that in 100 years after women had the right to vote, we now have a record number of women in the U.S. Congress, which I thought was a really nice gesture, given that most of those women are Democrats. And the Democratic women went wild. They started, clapping even more and raising the roof and chanting USA, USA. And so that really was, I thought, one of the moments where it really was a bipartisan feeling in the chamber at that point. And everyone is like this celebratory mode that I don't think the president anticipated that happening, certainly, but it was a nice gesture on his part to reach out to the women and recognize their historic achievement in that way.
President Trump also checked in on a number of foreign policy areas, North Korea, Iran, Middle East, more broadly, and the state of ISIS. What stood out to you about how he addressed success and previewed next steps when it comes to our relationships abroad?
Well, the problem with a lot of the speech, and foreign policy especially, was that with President Trump, there's so many times that he says things that aren't true that you don't know when he is saying something that is true unless you really know all of the facts. And so the foreign policy is a good example of this, where it is true that ISIS has really not been entirely defeated, but they're down to controlling now something like 20 square miles instead of tens of thousands of square miles in Iraq and Syria. So that is a major accomplishment that he did talk about. But then we talked about North Korea and the progress made on nuclear talks there.
One thing that he said is, if I hadn't been elected president, we'd be at war right now with North Korea. And you could see here some, again, audible kind of grumblings from the Democratic side when he said that. And that really, kind of on his face, is a sort of ridiculous thing to say. Like, how would you know if we'd be at war with Korea if Hillary Clinton had been president? Seems pretty unlikely to me, but, you know, like, who knows, I suppose. But to even say something like that just is not really useful. And he does have some accomplishments he could point to, that, you know, NATO payments. It's true that our NATO allies are paying more now for our NATO commitments than they had before. And so if he would have just focused on, you know, factually correct things rather than getting into these exaggerations, and I think it would have been a stronger case to be made for his presidency.
David, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's good to be with you.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. Up next, it's news. Then organizations like ProPublica created tools that would allow them to monitor targeted political ads on Facebook. But last month, Facebook blocked key features of those tools. We'll get the latest on this move. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Talking about Facebook and efforts for political ad transparency here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Back in December, we learned through a Senate report that Russia used every major social media platform in an attempt to interfere with the 2016 election. In the wake of this, Facebook launched a new structure for political ads, and a number of third-party organizations created tools to help people see how Facebook users were targeted by advertising. But those tracking tools that allowed users to share data from political ads they see on Facebook, those plugins, they no longer work. What have you noticed about the political ads you see on Facebook? Did you participate in ProPublica's project to gather information about targeted Facebook ads? What did you learn? Do you think information about the way Facebook sells ad spots should be publicly available, or does it even matter to you that Facebook targets its ads toward you? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jeremy Merrill is a journalist focusing on machine learning at Quartz. Previously, he was a news apps developer at ProPublica, where he was the lead journalist on a project tracking targeted political ads on Facebook. Jeremy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
So ProPublica and other organizations, including the web developer Mozilla, set up tools to create some transparency around targeted political ads on Facebook. Can you tell us about what ProPublica created in its tool?
Sure. So we ran a project, we're still running it, it's called the Facebook Political Ad Collector. And what it does is pretty simple. If you install it, you'll send the ads that you see on Facebook and Facebook's explanation of why you saw them to our database without any sort of personal information, just the ads. And we publish a database of the political ads. The thing that's really sort of shocking, once you spend many months staring at all these political ads, as I did, is that they really differ a lot on the basis of gender and age, the companies that you interact with, and of course, by your political ideology. We found that well over 70% of all the political ads that we saw before the midterm elections were highly targeted by ideology, in the sense that those ads were seen by at least four people who were liberal to each conservative who saw it, or vice versa. And it's the sort of thing where your sense of politics, if you're seeing a lot of these ads, is going to be different than someone who's on the other side, because you're just seeing people talk about totally different issues.
And so last month, Facebook blocked ProPublica's ad monitoring tool, and it blocked other organizations' efforts as well. Has ProPublica's tool been completely blocked? What's its status? Is it still functioning?
It's only partially functioning. We're still collecting some of the ads themselves. But one of the most important pieces of data that we can gather from these ads is the explanation that Facebook gives of the choices that the advertiser made in asking Facebook who to show who they should show the ad to. So if you're an advertiser, you might say, and suppose you are a conservative, you're a Republican candidate or a right-leaning interest group, you might say, hey, Facebook, I want you to show this ad about lowering car emission standards, let's say, just to men who are over 40 and who are Republicans or conservatives or like Sean Hannity, for instance. And it's really important, if you want to understand this ad and understand the political strategy that this group is using, to know that they made those choices. And that our ability to gather that information, the ability for our participants in this project to send us that information has been limited, has been turned off, has been blocked by Facebook.
So what are the risks of not knowing this information? What can we learn from knowing exactly how we're being targeted based on things like race, political persuasion, age, religion?
Well, there's the risk that the sorts of issues that I'm thinking about in terms of politics are going to be different from the ones that you're thinking about because you're just seeing a whole different set of persuasive messages. We know that a lot of political messaging is geared towards each party's base. This is because it's really hard to get someone who doesn't care a lot about politics to turn out. It's also really hard to get someone to switch their political views. And so political groups tend to focus on people who they think are already predisposed to vote for them or to support them. But what that means is that if you're not plugged into a really politically diverse set of people, you're not going to know what the issues are, the issues of the day are in our politics. And that can be kind of worrying for a democracy where we're supposed to be, figuring out these issues as we the people on a regular basis. And not to mention, if somebody, whether it's an American, political consultant who is engaging in sort of dirty tricks, or worse, sort of foreign meddling, like we saw in 2016, we know that people are going to try to finally target their messages for a particular purpose. We know that the Russian agents who were meddling in the 2016 election did a pretty good job of targeting just racial minorities or just conservatives for their messages, trying to divide people and sort of foment discontent. We know that the Russian ads were targeted, for instance, to people who were interested in the African American civil rights movement. Targeting racial minorities.
We're talking about Facebook's response to political ad monitoring and groups that are working for more transparency in how people are targeted for these ads. Jeremy Merrill is a journalist focusing on machine learning at Quartz. You can enter the discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you think information about the way Facebook sells ad spots should be publicly available, or is this level of monitoring and openness over the top? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jeremy, let's look at the Honest Ads Act that would require more information to the public. How could federal legislation impact political ads on social media platforms?
That's a good question. The Honest Ads Act was a bill that was introduced, but it didn't pass in the last Congress. And I'm told it's going to be introduced again sometime fairly soon in the current Congress. That bill would have required, it would have imposed some actual rules on online political advertising. Believe it or not, there are stricter rules for political ads on TV or radio that don't apply to online ads, even though online ads are a really growing piece of the sort of campaign landscape. It required the platforms, Twitter, Google, Facebook, folks like that, to maintain a database of the ads, which some of them are already doing right now, as well as telling you who actually paid for the ad and a description of the audience that was targeted by the ad, so that people can, journalists, activists, the general public can look through these and see, you know, what is the candidate who's talking to me saying to people who are different than me? What is a candidate who I'm not hearing from saying?
Is there any way of knowing who's actually purchasing these ads, knowing exactly the origin?
It's actually really tough because, A, there are sort of fewer regulations on the internet right now for political ads. And because even though Facebook, and Facebook in particular, says that they're going to tell you who's paying for political ads, if you saw political ads before the midterms, you might recall seeing political ads that say paid for by some group or some candidate. You know, it might say, you know, paid for by Tony Evers for governor. The thing is, though, based on some reporting that I did in October, Facebook actually isn't really checking who's paying for the ads. They have a box and the advertiser can fill it in, but Facebook doesn't check that they're telling the truth. They said that wouldn't be scalable. And so what that means is that there are groups there that don't exist. There were some ads paid for by a group called America Progress Now that was, we learned from the targeting information, was targeting just people who were very liberal across the Midwest, including in Wisconsin, and telling those folks to go and vote for Green Party candidates. Trick is, the Green Party didn't know, had never heard of this group. The name America Progress Now wasn't registered with the Federal Election Commission. It wasn't the legal name of a corporation. They listed an address in the Bronx in New York City. I reported the story with William Turton of Vice News. He went to their address, and nobody at the building had ever heard of the group. So we have no idea who they were. Facebook says it's paid for by America Progress Now, but that doesn't mean anything.
So why can't the political ads we see on social media platforms have the same types of rules that govern TV and radio political ads?
Something approximately like that is what the Honest Ads Act would do. But right now, for sort of obscure historical reasons, there just aren't as strict laws on online ads.
We're talking with journalist Jeremy Merrill about tools created to monitor how users are being targeted by political ads on Facebook. Facebook made changes so these plugins wouldn't work as well or at all, and instead launched its own tracking and transparency mechanisms, including this weekly ad archive report. Do you worry about Facebook? Have you stopped using it or limited your use since it's been in the news? Or do you think this level of transparency is overreaction? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email it to ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation with Jeremy Merrill in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Talking about how Facebook is blocking tools that monitor who buys ads that target you. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Facebook says its latest site update was intended to stay ahead of ad blockers and to tighten security, and it announced last week it'll launch a set of transparency tools on political ads by the end of June. What have you noticed about the political ads you get on Facebook? Did you participate in ProPublica's project to gather information about targeted Facebook ads? What did you learn? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jeremy Merrill is a journalist focusing on machine learning at Quartz. He was formerly a news app developer at ProPublica, working on the ground on this project tracking targeted political ads on Facebook. Let's go to the phones now with Ben joining us from Madison. Hi, Ben.
Good morning. I wanted to comment. I work as the marketing person for a bike shop, and we use Facebook very effectively to target people who are interested in bikes and cycling and fitness and so forth. It's a wonderful platform for that. It's amazingly powerful, like nothing else that has ever existed. wonderful for us. The downside is that Facebook, as your guest and many other writers and reporters have described, is terrible at transparency. They have terrible ethics. They keep saying they'll do better, and they don't. And meanwhile, so many people are using it so happily, oblivious to the invasion of privacy and what it's doing to democracy. It's really a terrible thing. I don't see that stuff changing with the power that it offers to marketers.
Well, Ben,
for good or evil.
Ben, what could Facebook do to reform itself? How could it improve its transparency?
I don't think it will do this, but in an ideal world, they would hire a board of privacy experts and other folks, give those folks power to audit the company. They need someone to watch the watchers, and they would do this publicly and transparently and then hold themselves accountable to whatever this group decides they ought to do in terms of privacy.
Jeremy Benn is saying that Facebook is amazingly powerful for a bike shop, but it's got a lot of issues.
I think Ben's right. That's one of the reasons why transparency around political ads is so important, is because it is so powerful. Rather than sort of vaguely targeting the, if you want to reach seniors, traditionally you might target, you know, game shows that are on during the day. But, you know, on the one hand, everybody can watch that, which means it's got great transparency. On the other hand, you're not speaking directly, precisely to your audience if you're a political marketer. Just like Ben's Bike Shop can talk directly to cycling hobbyists, which is totally fine and great. It means that political marketers can target, you know, small slivers of the American public in a way that can be totally fine or can be kind of worrying.
So what explanation has Facebook given for blocking these monitoring tools? How has the company responded?
Well, they told us that this was as you said, to block ad blockers. But they didn't give me examples when I asked them of which ad blockers they were going after in particular, because the specific, it can get kind of in the weeds, but the exact specific thing they did interfered with a button that we use to gather this targeting information. And I'm not aware of, and they wouldn't give me an example of an ad blocker that uses that button. So their explanation was a little bit confusing. And they also said, oh, the database of ads that we publish is what we encourage you to use instead of our own tool. The thing is that the database that they've published is insufficient in a couple of ways, including sort of the most glaring one, is that it's just missing a lot of political ads. These aren't sort of gray area things. It's just ads from the NRA, or ads calling for healthcare reform, ads about civil rights, we've found aren't included in their archive, kind of mysteriously.
Well, so its archive, as of yesterday, had nearly 2.7 million ads in the archive with expenditures of $468 million. And this is not a one-off report. This comes out weekly. So can you look at that breakdown of how much a group spent and that level of transparency? What is it not telling you?
It's not telling you a lot of things. It's missing ads. The people who it says paid for ads, as we were talking about before the break, sometimes isn't right. And most importantly, it doesn't let you see, and it doesn't let you sort of query the database by who was targeted to see an ad. If you wanted to see who is showing ads just to racial minorities or just to seniors, you wouldn't be able to do that on Facebook's database. You can do it on ours when it works. What's more, it's also missing ads that are not political, which can also be the site of trouble. We found ads where people who were hiring for jobs asked Facebook, hey, Facebook, show this ad for a job just to men. No joke, one of these ads was for work in a sausage factory. And that's a thing that Facebook says this is against the rules, but it still happened. And this is something that's the subject of a legal action in front of the EEOC right now.
So where does Facebook go from here? Because it announced on Twitter last week that it's coming out with new transparency tools by the end of June. So in the first half of this year, there'll be new transparency tools around political ads. What are you expecting?
Well, it's hard to imagine that they will be better at detecting political ads in other countries than they are here in the United States. Based on our reporting, we found that they've missed a lot. They're missing a lot of stuff in the United States. Their database doesn't answer all the questions that we need it to. And right now, there are elections that are ongoing in Ukraine, Israel, Guatemala, Canada's coming up, and in the European Union. And right now, if it were not for third-party transparency tools like ours, and since ours aren't fully working, folks in those countries are left completely in the dark.
So what can Facebook users here in the States who are concerned about political ads and the targeting, what can they do?
Well, if you want, you can participate in our project. Just Google Facebook Political Ad Collector and ProPublica. But you can also talk to your friends, talk to your elected officials about what your opinion is, because at the end of the day, we live in a democracy and the people get to decide how political ads work in our country.
But at the end of the day, lots of people are on Facebook for a whole host of reasons. It's really a communication lifeline.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying people have to quit Facebook. People have all sorts of great reasons to be on Facebook. But they should make sure folks are aware of how the platform works for political ads and for non-political ads, as Ben was saying about privacy. The more people understand, the better decisions they'll be able to make.
You've moved away from ProPublica, but what is the next step for third-party developers as they monitor transparency at Facebook and other social media platforms?
Well, I know that I am, and some of these other third-party tools, folks are still working hard to find a way around this to make sure that we can provide this really essential transparency.
So, like, new tools coming out there? I mean, so if Facebook shuts down a particular plugin, do you work on a different one? Or how, you know, it sounds like there's a little bit of back and forth here on the technology side.
There absolutely is. You're right. A lot of back and forth about, they change something and we change our plugin to match it. I'm really hopeful that pretty soon I'll be able to get the same plugin we've been using. I'll be able to get it back up and running again. I just haven't, I was working on it last night. Haven't found a solution yet.
So it is certainly a work in progress. Well, Jeremy, thank you for joining us and explaining.
Yeah, thank you all for having me on.
Jeremy Merrill is a journalist focusing on machine learning at Quartz. Previously, he was a news apps developer at ProPublica, where he was the lead journalist on a project tracking targeted political ads on Facebook. Just ahead, Jim Leary, our guest, was nominated for a Grammy for writing the album notes for Alpine Dreaming, the Helvetia Records story. We're talking about America's first Swiss record label here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.